Aimé Césaire, in Discourse on Colonialism, published originally in 1959, had a section that I thought was a very appropriate way to begin my talk. So I want to borrow from Césaire, if you'll bear with me. He says as follows: first, we must study how colonization works to decivilize the colonizer, to brutalize him in the true sense of the word, to degrade him, to awaken him to buried instincts, to covetousness, violence, race hatred, and moral relativism. And we must show that each time a head is cut off or an eye put out in Vietnam, and in France they accept the fact, each time a little girl is raped, and in France they accept the fact, each time a Madagascan is tortured, and in France they accept the fact, civilization acquires another dead weight, a universal regression takes place, a gangrene sets in, a center of infection begins to spread, and that at the end of all these treaties that have been violated, all these lies that have been propagated, all these punitive expeditions that have been tolerated, all these prisoners who have been tied up and interrogated, all these patriots who have been tortured, at the end of all the racial pride that has been encouraged, all the boastfulness that has been displayed, a poison has been distilled into the veins of Europe. And slowly but surely the continent proceeds towards savagery. And then one fine day the bourgeoisie is awakened by a terrific boomerang effect. The Gestapos are busy, the prisons fill up, the torturers standing around the racks invent, refine, discuss. People are surprised, they become indignant. They say, how strange, but never mind, it's Nazism, it will pass. And they wait and they hope. And they hide the truth from themselves that it is barbarism, the supreme barbarism, the crowning barbarism that sums up all the daily barbarisms. That it is Nazism, yes, but that before they were its victims, they were its accomplices. That they tolerated that Nazism before it was inflicted on them, that they absolved it, shut their eyes to it, legitimized it, because until then it had been applied only to non-European peoples. That they have cultivated that Nazism, that they're responsible for it, and that before engulfing the whole edifice of Western Christian civilization in its reddened waters, it oozes, seeps, and trickles from every crack. Yes, it would be worthwhile to study clinically in detail the steps taken by Hitler and Hitlerism, and to reveal to the very distinguished, very humanistic, very Christian bourgeois of the 20th century that without his being aware of it, he has a Hitler inside him, that Hitler inhabits him, that Hitler is his demon, that if he rails against him, he is being inconsistent, and that at bottom, what he cannot forgive Hitler for is not the crime in itself, the crime against man. It is not the humiliation of man as such. It is the crime against the white man, the humiliation of the white man, and the fact that he applied to Europe colonialist procedures, which until then had been reserved exclusively for the Arabs of Algeria, the coolies of India, and the niggers of Africa. We gather together at a critical moment for the world's greatest empire. It is, however, a paradoxical situation, being both very powerful and very vulnerable. The facts of the current economic situation are across the news media. Yet understanding why the situation has not translated into the sort of resistance movement that one could logically expect necessitates an analysis that goes to the core of the very existence of the United States. While it is absolutely true that the crisis of socialism, exemplified by events such as the collapse of the Soviet bloc and a turn toward capitalism by China, have contributed toward a sense among many that capitalism may be triumphant, the deeper problem goes to the soul of the U.S. itself, and that soul is linked to the interrelationship of empire, race, and indeed settlerism. Time does not permit an exhaustive analysis of any of these categories, but I would offer a few thoughts on each and then conclude with the possible implications for us in the dawn of the 21st century. As the late Theodore Allen, along with other theorists such as Lerome Bennett Jr. and David Roediger, have noted, race as a social construct rather than a fact of biology was introduced first in Ireland and later in the United States as a means of accomplishing two projects. The first, of course, was to justify, in the case of Ireland, the all-round suppression of the indigenous people. The second project was to drive a wedge between the indigenous Irish and the poor settlers sent there by the English crown, thereby creating a bond between the settler and the crown that has lasted over 500 years. In the case of the 13 colonies and later the United States, race became a means to justify the African slave trade and the exploitation of African labor. It also became a means to justify the wars of annihilation against the First Nations, Native Americans, and eventually the war of aggression against Mexico and the demonization of the Asian. But just as in Ireland, it became a means of social control over the laboring population, slave and free, ensuring a lasting bond between, in this case, the white settler laborer and the white settler employer elite. The relative differential in treatment between the white laborer and the African slave was critical in that the white laborer, while always being susceptible to bondage, was never eligible to become a slave. This bond was enforced over the years, in fact taking decades to put into place, despite the resistance of Africans and Europeans, at least initially. What is not sufficiently discussed, though, is the obvious fact that the United States is founded, or was founded, as a settler state. That is, what was once British North America was not the evolution of a formerly feudal kingdom into a semi-capitalist and then fully capitalist society. The British Empire expanded, as we know, and established a system that has parallels in other parts of the world which were victimized by British colonialism. It is in the essence of the settler state that one discovers additional obstacles to overcoming the consciousness and practices so graphically described by Césaire. British-shaped colonialism placed no value, for example, on a mestizo group, that is a mixed European and Native American population. Contrary to Spanish and Portuguese colonialism, the British set out to destroy the First Nations altogether. While it is true that in the Caribbean, the British utilized mulattoes as an intermediary group for purposes of social control, British North America was a settler colony where the objective of the British was not simply to produce goods to ship back to Europe, but as a locale to establish a new social formation, what would eventually be the United States. U.S. capitalism then has at its foundations racist oppression and settlerism, both with intertwining ideologies and practices. In settlerism, and one can see this throughout the world, wherever there's a settler state, there are very interesting qualities, and I want to make note of three. One is relativism. Settler ideology has only one absolute, whatever is good for the settler. The famous example of this relativism can be found in the sagas of the wars against the First Nations. When Indians would win a battle, of course, it would be declared by whites to have been a massacre. When the whites would win, the whites would declare it a military victory. But this can also be seen in treaties. Between 1783 and 1868, there were well over 300 treaties signed by the United States with various Native American tribes. Overwhelmingly, these treaties were broken by the whites when it was to their advantage to do so. A second feature, religious and quasi-religious myth. Settler states are generally speaking inspired by religious or quasi-religious myths. The settler, of course, is the center of the universe, and normally God is alleged to have had a role in this story. God supposedly grants the land to the settler to do with what he or she wants. God, in each case, seems to have a direct line with the settlers, because the indigenous never seem to hear God's voice. Connected to this is the myth that the land had been abandoned or was not being used by the indigenous people, if they were there at all. A third feature, racial superiority. A key ingredient is that the settler, a white from Europe, is superior to the indigenous people in all aspects. This superiority is demonstrated in many ways, not the least of which is military victories over the indigenous. The racial superiority can play itself out in a racial hierarchy, as we've seen in the United States. In the history of the U.S., then, race and settlerism are a firm foundation for the drive towards empire. For the U.S., that empire began as a continental enterprise rather than the establishment of overseas territories. It is worth noting that the Founding Fathers, so-called, for the Founding Fathers, there was no contradiction between a republic and an empire any more than there was a contradiction between democracy and slavery. In the racial settler mindset, the only relevant population was the white. And as long as they were not enslaved, there was a democracy. And as long as they were not controlled by a foreign power, they represented a free republic. The drive toward empire in the U.S. was so fascinating because it was largely done without the use of the word empire. And if the word was used, it was more descriptive. There was instead the tremendous use of euphemism, as one sees in the Monroe Doctrine and in the subsequent amended version of the Monroe Doctrine by Teddy Roosevelt in the early 20th century. For the U.S., empire was driven largely through economic relations reinforced by military might. In that sense, Thomas Friedman's famous notion that there is no McDonald's without McDonnell Douglas, and there is no hidden hand without the hidden fist, is not a description of neoliberal capital, but instead a description of the history of capitalism in general, and definitely a history of U.S. capitalism. In a settler mind, the U.S. was advancing civilization and removing obstacles to civilization. This was true for them, irrespective of whether they were destroying the First Nations, enslaving Africans, or stepping on Latin Americans and Filipinos. There was no one to hold a settler accountable because, at least in the settler's myth, they were only to be held accountable by God. And after all, God had given them a mission to go forth and conquer the land, whether in this case the land was North America or in an alternative setting, whether it was the Boers conquering South Africa. Race, settlerism, and empire have become such relevant categories in understanding not only the Iraq War, but for that matter, all U.S. foreign policy. In fact, I would argue that one cannot understand U.S. foreign policy, even if one claims to be on the left, without grasping the role of race, settlerism, and empire in the construction of the U.S. social formation. Insofar as race and settlerism numb many of us to the sufferings of other people, it becomes easier for us to understand the complacency that we see in the face of criminality. The experiences and lives of the global South are simply irrelevant. They are experiences and lives that really do not count. At best, and we saw this in the aftermath of the great Southeast Asian tsunami a couple of years ago, those of the global South are no more than a brown mass that can barely be understood by North Americans. Read that, white North Americans. Until and unless it is explained to us by other North Americans, or at least by Europeans. The daily reports of death and destruction in Iraq become background noise. Unless it is our children who are being killed, it is only a stat, some sort of perverse baseball game where one keeps the statistics, watches the players, and hopes that the home team wins at the end of the day. You know, I come out of and am very much a part of organized labor. And within organized labor, there's a recurring tendency to believe that working people can somehow be inoculated against what are often called wedge issues. Many wedge issues are connected to race, settlerism, and empire. The idea is simple for this inoculation. Describe to people how they're getting screwed by the rich and the corporations, and they will get furious and bring forth a mass resistance movement. Well, people often do become furious, and yes, they often do turn against the rich and the corporations, but they do not necessarily do that from a progressive or left standpoint. They may just as easily be won to right-wing populism and start to describe the enemy as the Jew, the black, the gay, or the immigrant, and unite those categories with the notion of the rich. But they might not even get that far. They may be furious, but insofar as they hold on to the prerogative of empire and the superiority of the settler, they can ignore other concerns, all in the name of patriotism, in the name of defending the empire. This is not just a U.S. phenomenon. You can see the same thing in other empires, but that goes beyond the scope of my talk. So let me conclude with this suggestion. A great man once said, if you do not hit it, it won't fall. There is no way to inoculate against race, settlerism, and imperial consciousness. These must be taken on and taken out. No, I'm not talking about yelling at people. I'm speaking about engaging in a combination of struggles and political education that challenges these ideologies and practices. This means confronting institutions and policies that reinforce racist oppression, that reinforce settlerism, and reinforce imperialism. It means drawing connections so that we can move away from this naive sense that actions, such as the war in Iraq, are accidental or divergences from an otherwise clean U.S. foreign policy. It is just this point that got Reverend Wright into so much trouble. He was, like so many other African Americans who have seen the underside of the American dream, drawing what I would call forbidden connections. That is, connections based on an analysis derived from our own cold and brutal experiences in North America. He was pointing out that the ambitions of the United States are not noble, but are driven by other forces such as greed and avarice. For telling this plain truth, he was demonized in some sectors and quietly and not so quietly applauded in others. At a mass level, we must fight for a different foreign policy, what I've been calling for years a democratic foreign policy with a small d, which actually alters the relationship between the U.S. and the rest of the world. This is admittedly a reform since we are located in the center of a global empire, but it is a badly needed reform if we are in any way to support the efforts of people around the world to achieve national self-determination, lasting peace, and a sustainable environment. To do this, my friends, means also stepping away from the racial settler precipice, where we privilege our experiences over the rest of the world, where we privilege our hurt over the hurt experiences throughout the world, hurt that's often brought about at the hands of the United States, where we privilege our right to uphold a living standard that is often abetted by outright theft. No, this is no call for poverty, but it is a call for domestic and global equity. And this must be introduced into all of our discussions about foreign policy, including, but not limited to, discussions concerning Iraq. I don't think that the problem currently in the peace movement, the anti-war movement, is anti-communism at all. I think that the problem is that we don't have a vibrant revolutionary left in the United States that plays the role or anything approximating the role of what the Communist Party, the Mustites, and others did in the 30s. And I don't mean that we don't have groups handing out newspapers. Right? But we don't have the same kind of vehicle for advancing the kind of change that's necessary. And one of the problems in all social movements is that we attempt to try to figure out an answer to our dilemma without addressing the question of the mechanisms that are necessary in order to move the people's movements forward. And it just doesn't happen out of thin air. But it's precisely because of what you were raising. And I think that is critically important. In Vietnam, one of the things that we've got to keep in mind that I think complicates the situation in Iraq compared to many other situations is that in Vietnam, there was the National Liberation Front. There was the National Liberation Front that had a very coherent view, that had active outreach around the world to various forces. In Iraq, we have nothing like that. We have a movement or movements that are very different, and we have movements that are much harder for people in the United States to unite with, for sometimes good reasons and sometimes for terrible reasons. So I think that that's a real problem, and it's not just there. One of the experiences I had several years ago after the coup in Haiti was that the absence of a force on the ground in Haiti that could reach out to people in the United States made support work that much more difficult. It just did. It shouldn't be that way, but it did. And in that people were often unclear, how can they actually build support? Who are the good guys on the ground? And this is one of the things that we've got to figure out in terms of the nature of our work against the war. That this problem is a problem that ends up sometimes falling prey to anti-Muslim and anti-Arab biases. So I would just add that that's a difference between our situation in, when we were dealing with Vietnam versus the current situation. We owe a special debt. We owe the Arab people and the Muslim people. And that's a very unpopular thing to say because of the anti-Arab prejudice and anti-Muslim prejudice in this country, reluctance to recognize the great damage the United States has done in the Arab and Muslim worlds. Whether it was Iran in 53, Iraq in 63, the Sudan, Egypt, I mean, we can go on and on where religious and secular left-wing and nationalist movements were violently crushed by allies of the United States, including some of the forces that are currently called jihadists. And so there's a particular debt that we owe that we really do need to acknowledge, and it will be part of the reparations that we have to consider at some point. I mean, I think that there's two distinct right-wing currents that we have to worry about. One is the development of a neoliberal authoritarian state, which we have been seeing since the late 1970s, early 80s, and the growing, the shrinking space for alternative political discourse. But the other piece is right-wing populism. And right-wing populism has a very long history in the United States. And in response to a further economic downturn, I think that right-wing populism is one of the biggest dangers that we have to look out for, because right-wing populism has a very compelling argument. I mean, think about Pat Buchanan, who on the one hand, if he's talking at a certain moment, sounds like he's on the left, and then he says a couple of words and you think Himmler is standing next to him, right? And it's like, whoa! And the problem is we often get this confused because we'll say, well, we'll take part of what Buchanan is saying, but we'll leave aside it. No. For the right-wing populace, it's all a part of the same thing. It's all part of the same narrative. And so part of what our task really is struggling against right-wing populism, because it could very well become the major current. I was actually engaged in a discussion with some truckers recently who are involved in these struggles around prices, the price of fuel. And, you know, so I'm listening, I'm on this conference call, and these guys are really militant, right? And talking about, you know, we've got to do something, we've got to send these trucks into different cities, and blah, 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 blah. And then all of a sudden he says, and they get immigrants. I said, oh, man. You know, it's like you can't get away from it. And we've got to confront it. Because it's that hand that comes out of the grave and grabs us by the ankles. Because you can see in the United States, but you can also see in other parts of the world, and I want to talk specifically about right-wing Islamism, this anti-woman current that is specifically within the right-wing populism. It's the notion that the problem of the declining living standard for the man is directly related to the changing role of the woman. And so within Islam, you have this caricaturization of Islam to become within Islamism specifically, this idea that it is the man first, and this elimination of not only the rights, but the active involvement of women in society. You saw this, for example, in Afghanistan under the Taliban. What the Taliban instituted there had nothing to do with Islam, but it had to do with a male supremacist notion, and in fact, I'd say a fascist notion, of the assertion of the role of the man in response to the declining role of women. Assertion of the role of men in response to the increasing role of women, and the perception that it is the woman that, in fact, is challenging the man and is the reason that men are declining. So you had, for example, in many of these right-wing Islamist groups, a very highly educated, D-class male group that, in fact, look at the problem as compounded by three factors: U.S. imperialism, the corrupt authoritarian regimes, and women. And these three factors are identified as a problem. In the United States, within right-wing populism, we see actually much the same thing. We see this current that became very apparent in the 1980s, particularly in the farm areas, of the rise of these right-wing populists slash fascist groups that interpreted the declining living standard of white people as being based both on the rising role of minorities, but also the changing role of the women. So the whole notion of family values is nothing more than a reconstruction of male supremacist dominance. And so I think that this is one of these struggles that when we're talking about combating right-wing populism, it's why it's so important that we're addressing this issue of misogynism. It's not like an add-on to it. It's central to the right-wing populist narrative. Many of us, that particularly during the 90s, got seduced by this notion of humanitarian or human rights intervention. And we really misunderstood the motives behind what the United States was doing. And in general, our attitude should be, what do they say with physicians? First, do no harm. That should be the basic thing that we're talking about right now. First, do no harm. That there are things that the U.S. can actually do to support things, but they're not military. There's financial assistance, there's other things that can be done. But the idea of promoting military interventions is absolutely not something that we should encourage. And it would be very, very harmful. Within Black America, which is something that I focus more on when I'm talking about anti-war work, we have this paradox. We have the greatest anti-war sentiment of any other constituency in this country. The greatest. From the beginning, anti-war sentiment among Black Americans was at a low of about 60%. At a low, right? And you might have noticed over the last few years the reduction in the number of Blacks joining the U.S. military. Right? So you have this very deep opposition to the war and distrust of the U.S. The objectives of the U.S. in Iraq. That is not translating into our mobilization, and I think that it's not primarily because of errors on the part of the anti-war movement. And that may be heresy for some people, but I'm gonna just try to make it real as far as I'm concerned. I believe that it has more to do with things that are going on among us as African Americans, and that is the growth of despair and the reduction in the belief that struggle pays. You have, on the one hand, ideological opposition, and people will speak out around the war, but a feeling that we are not in a position to do something about it, which is one of the reasons that groups like the Black Radical Congress, Black Voices for Peace, were and are important in terms of rekindling that. I think that part of what our task is, with those in the Black left, is really to try to rebuild organizations and rebuild sentiment so that we're taking a lead in the anti-war movement, taking a lead in the global justice movement. If there is something that the white, predominantly white anti-war movement can do, it's to remember one very important thing. There is a big difference between diversity and inclusion. Diversity is how many people are at the table. Inclusion is who's making the decisions.